get to know you. We're going to talk it out. We're going to get to know you and what you're all about. We're going to get to know just what makes you feel alive. We're going to get to know how you build, lead, and thrive.
Build, Lead, and Thrive. Voices of the Androscoggin.
Welcome to Build, Lead, Thrive, Voices of Androscoggin, a bi-monthly podcast that features in-depth conversations with the people shaping Androscoggin County. Each episode dives into personal stories, showcasing the leaders and entrepreneurs behind the region's economic and community vitality. Hi, I'm your host, Shanna Cox, President and CEO of the LA Metro Chamber. I am joined by local talent, longtime friend, hilarious comedian, and our producer, Mark Turcock.
Hello.
Welcome.
How about that new jingle? We have the theme song, I should say.
I love it. I hope it's an earworm in everybody's ears, and they ask for more. Shout out to Ross,
yes,
one of our past guests who helped put that together when he realized our singing was both maybe a little bit illegal and definitely not great.
Some might say offensive.
Yeah. My family would probably tell you that it was offensive. My dad says, I can't carry a tune if it gave it to me in a bucket. I think my apple didn't fall far from that tree. It's great to see you again. And I do love the jingle.
Yeah, it's great.
I know. And it's been a minute since we saw each other.
Yes.
So folks will get excited about the kind of rapid succession that we'll be releasing episodes in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah.
More to come on that. Together, Mark and I highlight the leaders and entrepreneurs building a stronger economy and vibrant community right here in our region, sharing stories of how they build, lead, and thrive. Today, we're joined by Paul Karen. I am so excited to have you. Paul's a lifelong Lewiston resident, educator, musician, creative force behind a new home. Don't worry, we'll talk about that and you'll learn all about it. He has Franco-American roots and decades of contributions in theater, education, and music. Paul's story is woven deeply into the fabric of our community. We're excited to learn more about him, his journey, his creative process, and his vision for how the arts can inspire connection, resilience, and leadership. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's such a pleasure to have you. We're going to cover a lot of ground today on a new home. But as I dug deeper into your bio, which I'll share a little bit more for our guests, you aren't just arts. You have this whole academic life in leadership studies, too. And so I'm excited to see how we can weave those threads together in today's conversation. Leadership tends to be one of the themes that we touch back on often in this podcast. And so I'm just super excited. Thanks for saying yes.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Welcome. I'm glad to be here.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. Let's share a little bit more about Paul. So Paul's a lifelong Lewiston resident with many roles, educator, composer, director, community volunteer, that reflect a deep commitment to the arts, learning, and local history. He comes from a large Franco-American family and grew up near, this is my favorite, the iconic gas tank on Lincoln Street. I think you described it in your bio as the patch of gas tank and ball?
It was called the gas patch, and it was a big, gigantic natural gas ball that held the gas, but there was also a big tank that a lot of people don't remember. That was taken down a long time ago. Both were taken down, but it was on the corner of Lincoln and Locust Street.
So that's where that big parking lot is that the gas company
still
owns.
Exactly, yeah. That was a big, gigantic ball. You see sometimes pictures in other areas of around the country. They still have them. And the tank is similar if you go down, I think, at Route 93 in near Dorchester. You see those big, tight tanks.
Yeah.
It was something like that.
And I always thought those were water tanks, and it's blowing my mind since I read your bio to think about those just being natural gas stores all over the U.S.
Oh, yes.
Big balls.
Yeah, right next to our house.
You turned out great. No lasting impacts there. I loved that description in the bio that you shared. I went a little bit deeper, and so I've got some additional points that I want to offer our guests about you. Specifically, so you hold a PhD from Boston College in curriculum instruction and administration. So when we talk about all of your contributions to arts and theater, behind it is this academic guy who has his PhD, and that you still are doing work in that field. So you had prior degrees in science and mathematics. You have held roles as director of secondary education at St. Joseph's College. You served as a science and math consultant for the Auburn school system. And then right here at the University of Southern Maine, you're an associate professor of leadership and organizational studies.
Right. That's what I do, so I can do the arts part.
It's like the left and right brain coming together in this beautiful way. His theater and musical work stretches back decades. Paul first became involved in the Lewiston Auburn Community Little Theater, or as we might refer to it, CLT, in 1989 as a rehearsal pianist and pit conductor for West Side Story, which... I love theater, and I just saw West Side Story for the first time ever in any format this summer.
Wow.
So it's wild that that's where you got your start, at least locally. Yeah, well, it was at Maine State Music. Yeah.
Well, I had done, I was teaching at St. Dom's. I started there in 1979 when no one was alive. And I got involved with the theater program there, so I started doing musical directing for high school productions for about 8 years, and then I was asked to come in with John Blanchette, asked me to be the rehearsal pianist for West Side Story in the summer of 89. And then from there, it's been
one
over,
thing led to
right,
another.
Exactly.
It's like the professional version of if you give a mouse a cookie.
That's right. And I wanted the whole sleeve.
So don't I, usually. Over the years, you've taken on more than 50 productions in capacities ranging from director, music director, actor, and collaborator. You credit your early connections as key to how you first gained a foothold in the CLT scene. So then fast forward, in 1995, you wrote the music and lyrics for Lewiston, A New Home, for Lewiston's Bicentennial, an original music project that was reflecting the city's Franco-American and Irish immigrant stories. That show enjoyed sold-out runs and an original cast recording that was released. And now, decades later, you have helped reimagine and expand it into A New Home, which was adapted from the Lewiston A New Home, which was originally kind of a book that compiled all of the screenplay, the music, by Michael Rosenthal, Richard Martin, and Lynn Geiger. Love to give credit where that's due.
Yes.
How am I doing so far?
So far, so good.
Okay, great.
I'm tired.
Yes. I mean, you've lived an incredible life, and I think oftentimes we, in community or even where we're consuming content, we see someone in this moment for the thing they're being presented for, and I love this opportunity and this platform to say, like, but how did you get here? What are the pieces that led to this moment and the thing you're doing right now? And this, I think that you've lived an incredible life and it's worth sharing. So you adapted the work to reflect Lewiston's more recent history and evolving demographics. We'll talk about that a little bit more in depth. You describe your ongoing passion for live theater in deeply human terms. I managed to find an old interview of you. It offers a way for people of diverse backgrounds and talents to come together on stage, backstage, and in the audience to tell shared stories. When not working on theater, Paul leads choirs for his parish, plays music for services, and you read. So much reading.
A lot.
I'm also a reader, and it's always nice to have someone else who you do the New York Times crossword daily.
Boy,
that's a step I don't do.
How did you find out?
I listen, right? Thank you. My research skills are, I've been really honing them. What I really love is that on a more personal level, Paul is married to Susan and affectionately called her his dancing in beauty.
That's one of the songs in the show.
Is it?
Yes.
It's
subtitled Susan's Song.
Which you wrote.
Yes.
Don't know, and we'll make sure we're sharing more about this. A New Home returns to the CLT stage this fall, coming right up. And Paul's work bridges memory and possibility, offering Lewiston Auburn a chance to reflect on what has been and reimagine what might yet be. And it's that last piece that we center so much of our conversations in this podcast on, that the story that we tell about ourselves is only part of the story, and we have the opportunity to continue writing it. And it's just everything that you're doing is kind of built into that. So Did I get anything wrong?
No. I'm just amazed at your research skills.
Thank you.
I wish you were in my research class.
You tell those students to come on That's over and right. have a podcast yes. learning session with me. So before we dive into all of that and go a little bit deeper, we like to start out a little light touch, a little segment getting to know you, which is the impetus for the jingle and the reason we no longer sing. You're welcome. So before we dive into a new home and your creative and professional journey, we want to get to know just the person behind the work a little bit. We always start with a few fun questions. So if you weren't teaching and directing musicals, what other career might you have chosen?
Well, this is going to sound like I'm pandering to Mark, but when I was in high school at St. Dom's, I was a St. Dom's student, I wanted to be a DJ. Those were the days when we had three radio stations in town with WLAM, WCOU, and WPNO. And I don't know if there's a certain age group that would remember all of those three
Mark's
stations.
Nodding like he's in.
In fact, WCOU was just down here on Lisbon Street. Huh. And WLAM was the station that played Top 40. And in those days, this is the 60s, Top 40 could be from Edith Piaf to the Beatles to Glen Campbell. And you'd hear all these songs. But I just loved the idea of playing records all day. And I even looked at when I was a junior, looking at the Northeast Broadcasting School was a place to go to. It was in Boston or near Boston. I don't know what it's called now. And I didn't end up doing that. I went to Lowell Tech.
You did all this other stuff instead.
Yeah, and all this other stuff because I heard myself on a tape. I had a little tape recorder, reel-to-reel tape recorder, and I would say things like, here's a song, and I would listen to myself, and I had this heavy French accent and nasally voice, and it was like, I can't do that. So I said, I'll go into engineering, because that's what people from this area did. You didn't go to the shoe shops, you went to the engineering. Yeah. And I remember going out for civil engineering, and we were outside, and I was holding the Philadelphia rod, that's that big rod that when they do surveying, and it was freezing. And I said, I don't want this job. So I changed to math and became a teacher.
See?
So that's the end of my DJ days.
So like short-lived and on your own cassette player?
Yes. Yeah, that's you just played, it was reel-to-reel, and you would record songs immediately from the radio station. You had to wait for your favorite song to come on.
Music's been a constant in your life. What is your favorite? This is going to be so hard for you to ask. You can pass. But I'm going to ask it anyway because I'm hopeful that you'll dive in. What's a favorite song or performance that still gives you goosebumps when you hear it?
The song Bridge Over Troubled Water.
Oh.
1970. Simon and Garfunkel, number one song of the year, number one album of the year. It won a ton of Grammy Awards. That one, because it has a big piano introduction. Mm-hmm. Larry Nechtel, he was an icon in the studio, and he played the piano. In fact, he won a Grammy just for playing that piano part. And I was learning how to play the piano. I was teaching myself, so I would buy the sheet music down here on Lisbon Street. There were some stores, Mars Music, Mars Stromboli's, and I would put it there, and I would listen to the song just over and over and try to connect the dots as to what he's playing and the piano part is. The Beatles did the same thing, but Bridge Over Troubled Water is still the song that if I had one song to listen to for the rest of my life, that would be it.
That's an excellent choice. Yeah. I mean, the minute you said it, it was playing in my head, and I also got goosebumps. It is an astounding song.
Yeah.
Both the lyrics and the music kind of moves you through a bit of an emotional journey. What is your go-to comfort food in Lewiston, Auburn? What's your favorite thing to...
Can I name the place?
Yeah.
All right.
Absolutely. We do shout-outs all the time.
Okay. My wife and I go to Pat's Pizza a lot. And I'll have a pizza with... It sounds weird, but double green peppers, mushrooms, fresh mushrooms, and pineapples. I know that's controversial, but too bad.
It's a controversy we revisit in my house. My guy's a pineapple and pepperoni.
Oh.
Usually we get veggie pizzas because I'm not going to eat that with him. Right. And I love a good veggie pizza.
Yeah.
But he's not asked to put the pineapple on the veggie pizza yet. I'll say yes if he does, but just once. When you're not teaching, directing, or composing, how do you recharge? Also, do you find time to do that? And then when you're not doing all the other things?
I walk. I try to keep fit so I can stay active as I age. So I walk about 4 miles a day, and in that time, it's the most creative part of my day. I've done a lot of composing and writing of the script, and even staging, blocking in my mind, so that when I get home and later, I always work at night. The morning is for exercise, the afternoon is for school, at night is for the theater. So when I was writing the play, okay, what did I think about today in my walk? Mm. And it came out very quickly. So it's still working, but you're still getting some fitness out there. But that's the most creative part of the day, is just going out for a walk.
I love that. All right, so since we've known you just a little bit more, let's dig a little bit deeper. In our first segment, Build, it's all about building, creating opportunities, strengthening institutions, and investing in people. I'm curious, how did your upbringing, you've mentioned it a couple of times, not just in your bio, but your like heavier French accent. How did your upbringing in Lewiston and your Franco-American family shape your life and your love for music and performance?
I was lucky. I had two French Canadian families, both on both sides of the family, my father and my mother. My mother, she grew up next to the gas patch, and my father bought a house right next to Memel. But his family grew up on 414 Lisbon Street, right across the street from here.
Yeah.
Before it was the
bakery,
for
sure.
It was near the corner of Birch. Birch came all the way down to Lisbon Street, and they lived right here, and they had a little restaurant called Karen's Restaurant. It was across the street from here, which used to be Bisson's Market. Now, this was a little market here, and so this was the community. So we would have music all the time. Mm. And my mother's side of the family, I have uncles still. The Sessie Bone Band comes from that. That was a big band during the French Franco-American festivals.
Yeah.
They played at the Heritage Center. My uncle Nell is still a musician, and I learned that. So I would watch them. They just picked up the music and played. They didn't read music. I wanted to read music, but I learned how to vamp. I learned how to change keys. I learned how to play by ear by watching them. Both sides. My father's father, grandfather. It was a little bit more formal. We always had to wear a white shirt and tie when we went to visit those
grandparents. Was there plastic on the furniture?
No.
Oh, not that formal.
No, not that formal. Because they lived on the second floor apartment, and the first floor apartment was the restaurant, and you could hear the jukebox playing upstairs, and you'd hear the beat, especially the bass. But there it was more like dance for grandma or play for grandma. They had a piano, so you just learned to play. And my aunt sang, so I learned to accompany her. And in fact, she's still singing, and I just accompanied her about 2 months ago because she did a demo for one of the songs that is in the show. She had done it originally 30 years ago, and now she's in her late 80s, and she did it again just as a favor. So been doing that since I was a kid, since I was 8 or 9 years old, just playing and watching. But the other thing, it was listening to the stories that they talked about. They worked in the mills. Mm-hmm. Some of them were born in Canada, came here, my father's older brother and sister were born in Canada. They came. So I learned to listen to the stories, learned to listen to what happened in the mills. So that's the part of the family upbringing that sort of formulated the thoughts in my head as to some of the stories that are in the play.
Yeah. And would have permeated, I'm sure, all the way through.
Like, right.
It informs the lens that you move
exactly.
through your life with.
Exactly.
So you've been involved with CLT since 89. What do you think that the role CLT and theater in general has played in building community here in LA?
There's always an emphasis on getting people involved in all areas of the theater. But I think we stress the word community as to not just being on stage, but being behind the scenes.
Yeah.
There's a lot of work that goes into making a production. You need craftspeople. You need people who are artistic in terms of lighting and costume and mm-hmm. set design and set decor. Those are not my strengths. I don't have a good eye for that, but I'll tell you what I like when I see it.
Yeah.
It's very difficult sometimes to describe this to your set construction. I want this thing to do that thing. Mm. And that's about all I give them. And I want it to look like this. And
well, at least you're not an over-directive director.
It's like I'll say, I need my actors to be able to do that. Can you do a table or a flat or something that will do that? But it's also it's the excitement of putting on a show. Yeah. It's almost like back to Judy and Mickey Rooney days. Let's put on a show. At a craftsman-like level. And also, I think what's happening now is that they're going outside of the theater to be involved in more community events. I think it's also welcoming to people of all types of people and to be accepting of all types of people. You could say that theater and in other areas, it's like an island of misfit toys. It's like everybody has some type of gift, and sometimes it's not appreciated outside.
That.
And so we try to appreciate what gifts you have, no matter the flaws that come with it, so we can accept you as a human being. And I think that's one of the things that theater attracts people. It attracts people in high school, those kids in high school that go there or go in band. They're not necessarily the cool kids, but then they end up being in an area that they are cool or that they can...
I was a band kid.
Yeah.
And it's like, same story.
Wow. It's like you really can do that. And unfortunately, sometimes it takes till your senior year till you're appreciated and seen. That happened with me, but that's okay. But you were still appreciated and honored for whatever talent you had. And that's what I think community theater does.
I think you're right. I've seen firsthand that impact, that everything that you just described. I have friends in theater. I have friends connected to shows at CLT, have for a long time. And the confidence that they get from like being seen for those skills in a place, and the way that permeates into other spaces, the way they bring that creativity into other spaces, it's very likely that a listener has been touched by someone who did something because of something they learned or connected through or grew through in theater, and it doesn't feel connected at all on the surface, and they have no sense that, like, thank God this coworker, or thank God this family member, thank God the person who just gave me service at this store or business is connected to theater because this experience was better because of it. I have seen firsthand. I'm fortunate to employ 3 CLT alum and friends. And I literally get to witness it every day in a very, very tangible way. And so I would just offer back to you, like, yeah, that is happening, and you're part of that. You're part of making that happen.
I hope so, and it's involved growth on my part from 1989 to here as an adult. To you learn, I had a reputation being a crusty old director, and I think after being married, it's sort of softened out because people say, "Boy, you're different now." It's like, yes, I am, because I can appreciate what other people bring to this table that I can't do, but I can appreciate that and honor your participation in this. It's like writing this play and this music. You were talking about singing. I've sung before, but some of these songs that I've written, I can't. I have people in mind because they can do a much better job in saying what I'm trying to say on paper and in music. They can say it much better than I can, and so that's a thrill to see that. And then they just talk to the people who build the sets or design it, and it's like, that's thrilling as well. And it goes all the way to people who do the ushering and that they're involved to make this whole thing work.
Mm-hmm. A New Home started decades ago with the Bicentennial and Lewiston, A New Home. What was it that inspired you to bring it back now?
So since it first came on, it was very popular. It won a New England Theater Award, the Moss Hart Award for Best Original Community Theater. So that's kind of cool. We were honored by the mayor, Mayor Jenkins at the time, who honored us and even made the last song called Lewiston in Me the city anthem. after a while, it goes away. And then they say, hey, what about that show? Would you do it again? And so some of the principals, like Richard Martin was the director, and we did a concert version in 2006 at the Franco Heritage Center, and it was just music and some clips from the video of the first play of the original. And then from there, this is why it's called A New Home. After that concert, someone came up to me. He was an Asian man, and he said, this is my story. And it struck me because we had written this with the Irish and the French. We wrote this in 1995. The concept of New Mainers was not in our thoughts. An Asian person came up to me and said, this is my story. And it made me think that this goes beyond just the Irish and the French, that there are other communities that have come here. We had we have Greek people, Italian people, and Asian people who have come to this city in the past 100 years or so, and even longer, to work, to build businesses, and so on. So from there, it made me think that we need to honor them in some other way, or at least expand on this. So as the years went by, around 2020, Richard was gone. He had retired. And so I said, well, maybe I can convince CLT to do this production, because to just create a show and then you don't have really a production company, which is what CLT is, to make this happen. Yeah. So I started walking and thinking about what I wanted to do. And
was it a longer walk that day?
Yeah, I actually used to run.
Yeah.
But then the age took over and the legs said, nope, not anymore. So, but about 2022 is when I got really serious, and then CLT said, okay, we'll do it. So I said, we have to have a song. We have to go from 95 to 2020, and we'll have a song that honors the New Mainers, because that's part of our heritage now, and they're in our community, and we can't just do the play in 95 and forget about it. Nothing happened after that.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? And then, while working on this, October 23 happened.
Yeah.
And so that, I remember going for those walks, because it was very eerily quiet in the city. And it just made me think that I can't end the play on that, let's celebrate the New Mainers. We have to honor the people who passed away in that tragedy. So that became part of the story as well. Continue the story, because if it's going to be about the history of Lewiston, or Lewiston's going to be the basis of this, you can't just forget that.
Yeah,
it's fresh in everybody's mind. So that's something that I worked on, and I came up with the idea that whenever this tragedy or someone, we all grieve. We are grieving in our family as well. So it's one of those things I thought. And from the beginning, I had a song called One More Goodbye. It seems like that's all we would like. If someone always says, if I could just have an hour back with my loved one who passed away. Title came first, was One More Goodbye, and so we created a song out of that, and that's the next to last song, because Lewiston and Me has always been the finale. So after we have the New Mainers, I added One More Goodbye, and I said, you know what we have to do is also honor the deaf community.
Yeah.
So right now, as a matter of fact, tonight is this lesson number 2. The cast is learning American Sign Language. So they are signing and singing the song at the same time.
That's
and
incredible.
It's about One More Goodbye. So they sing it and sign it. We have Roxanne Baker, who's our instructor. And she's from the deaf community, and she knew the victims, which makes it even special. And I hate to say this, you know what I mean by the word special, but it means meaningful. And so the cast has been practicing, because she came last week, so they've been practicing half the song. Today we finished the rest of the song. And that's going to be a special moment in the show.
Yeah.
So it's very very touching. When I see them on stage and now they're singing and signing the first part, Had a producer, Jennifer, came over and said it elevates the meaning of the song because now you're honoring that community as well as the people who passed away.
Yeah.
So that's something that came about just in the last couple of years after I had started working on this edition. And I wanted to focus more on the people, the characters. The first one was about Lewiston. It was Madeline in her 80s and 90s was sitting down at McCrory's, which used to be Kresge's. A long time ago, and they used to have booths to eat, and she's talking to a younger girl about the past, so then we go and reenact the past. Here I just start in, we honor the first Native Americans here, the first Native Nations of the Wabanakis, and we mentioned them, because they were here 12, 15,000 years before white settlers came, so we mentioned that in our first song, which is called Our Story. Each group has a story to tell. We're like a troop of actors coming into town. We're going to tell you a story for the next couple of hours. Mm. So we tell the stories and we follow Donovan, who's Irish, which is Justin, and Madeline, who's a Franco-American girl. And so it's a little bit like West Side Story, very mild, of course. It's just there's conflicts, mostly by the adults in their lives that don't want those two to be together. Right. And so we follow them throughout the events like World War I, the Depression, working in the mills, Peck's store, which was the big department store on Main Street that you might have probably remember. So we bring them all the way up to 2023-25. And so that's the change that has happened. And I call it a new home rather than Lewiston, a new home, because of that, what that Asian person said. It said, this is a new home for a lot of different people.
Yeah.
It's just not Lewiston. In fact, we don't mention the word Lewiston in the play, in the script at all.
Yeah.
It could be anybody. It could be Biddeford. It could be Waterville, other communities. It could be town, cities in New Hampshire, Fall River, where there's a mill, Lowell, Lawrence. Yeah. And so the only time the word Lewiston is mentioned is in a song three times. That's it.
That's incredible. Because I think there are, you know, as I hear you talk about the stories that you're telling, they are, so many of those stories are really universal.
Yes.
Right? And it sounds like it's not like you just plunked in some updates at the end. You, like, took a thoughtful look at the entire production and did an update that expanded as well.
Yes, I expanded the stories that were original were really about Lewiston. Lewiston was the story. Here it's Madeline and Donovan. So the first scene that after our story, Madeline and Donovan go to City Park, which is Kennedy Park now, and it's 1916. So you have the Irish on one bench, and then the French come in later, and they say, oh, here we go, da-da-da-da, and so on. And my father lived on Park Street before he lived on, and they would fight kids on Knox Street. It's like, wow, that hasn't changed much. And because they were French on Park Street, and they were Irish on Knox Street.
Yeah.
This is back in the 30s. So there was some, you know, head knocking in those days. So that's what you see is the tension between the two. Then they go and they fall in love and they get married and Donovan goes to war and we end Act One. We're not sure who's coming back because he has friends too going to war. So I added that in there because war, they are casualties, and I wanted to show that some of the people that the audience has gotten to know and probably care for, some of them are going off to war and we don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So come back for Act Two. And then we talk about working in the mill, what that was like. And here's where my family stories come into play with the song Factory Waltz. And that song is just the day-to-day, one, two, three, one, two, three, making all this. And when I was a kid, I would walk around Lincoln Street, Cedar Street, Chestnut Street, and you could go by the mills and you would hear the thump, 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 and then the scratching noise. And it was in my head, it was like 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, constant. I never worked in a mill like that in my life, so I was fortunate that generation we could move on to become an engineer. So that was all in my head as I'm going on, and I wanted to focus on that couple. During the Depression, it's hard times for Madeline and Donovan. It's not all a bed of roses. Like right. It's reality. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we've all heard our parents maybe having a heated discussion about either finances or kids, and we're upstairs or in the next room wondering what is going on, and we're scared. That's something that I wanted to bring into this play as well, that there's some hardship that they had to go through to be the people that we know and remember and love.
Yeah. You draw a mental picture really well of what it'll be like to experience that show, and I can't wait for it. I want to move us towards lead, and for us, this segment's about leadership in terms of guiding teams and communities and projects through challenges and opportunities. And I think you're just noting two challenges that our community has experienced: another influx of foreign-born population immigrants, and then asylum seekers, refugees, starting in 2000 and on, and then the October 25th tragedy. When you think about the things you've seen, the things you've had the opportunity to adapt this play with, the hats that you wear, educator and composer and director and a community volunteer, I'd go so far as to say community leader, how do you see your role as leader in those spaces?
I think it's trying to reach out to those communities to say that they can be involved. I'll give you an example. One of the challenges has been to bring like new Mainers into the theater. The Muslim community does not do staging, and I found that out early when I had a student, and she was listening to music. Said, "Oh, we do shows, da 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 da." She goes, "Oh, in our religion, we don't do that." Okay, that's a lesson for me. Yeah. So it's learning about the community. One of the things that I do in the parish is I have a choir, and there's also a New Mainers choir. They're mostly French Africans from the central, like Democratic Republic of Congo, Uganda, Rwanda, and they speak French much better than I can ever do. I'll say "Comment ça va?" and they go "Whoa!" I have Lincoln Street French, so slow down.
Gas patch French.
Exactly, gas patch French. So lovely to get to know them. And when we had after the events of October 2023, we had a special service at our church, a Holy Family Church, and we brought in different choirs, and they have a choir. I think it's the choir de Notre Dame, the Notre Dame choir, something like that. I'm sorry, I'm not getting it exactly right. And Dan Sill is the leader, and so I remember talking to Dan Sill back then. I said, "I'm doing this play, and I'm writing this section here, this play that," and it was. They came to do some demos. We did demos of the new songs that I wrote for this play. But it's just hard to get them to think that theater is a commitment to do this. So I think this generation just doesn't know yet that what it takes to be in a community. And I think as a leader, you just have to keep saying, "You can do this," or "You can be part of this. You have a story to tell." That's what, as a leader, you can do, is to honor each person's story. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to theater as a community of people of different talents. You have a special talent to show in this community that we can bring in. It's just like directing the show. It's like, okay, I have a script, and I want you to stick to the script. But then I'll see somebody do something, and it's like, "Oh, I like that." And they brought in whatever talent they can do, or a movement, or a way of speech. So as a leader, you have to be open to different things. You can't be so narrow-minded that it's my way or the highway. So that's one of the things in terms of getting new people involved. Yeah. And I hope, as a leader in a community, that we can get people involved because they have a lot to share. They sing. They sing very well. They sing together. Very family oriented. I hate to say the word they because it's the community as we're learning, as I'm learning more about the community and talking to people like Dancil. Dancil came to my house to talk about her story. And at the time, she was waiting for her husband who had been 10 years back in Africa. And it's like, I thought at first that's a story I could put in the play, but I didn't. But it sounds a lot like what immigrants have done. Yeah. Even when we read stories of immigrants coming through Ellis Island and they built their life in New York, in the Lower East Side, for years waiting to get enough money to bring their relatives back from Europe or wherever, or going Pacific or Asia. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like that's the story of America.
Yeah.
That's the real story. So I guess I'm going off on a tangent.
No, I think you're not. I think that's leadership. Right. I think that's leadership. Part of what I heard you articulate is you refer to it as not being narrow-minded, which, yes, and there's a rigidity, right? Like there's narrow-minded in terms of like not being able to kind of like broaden your thinking. Leaders who are rigid, it's not just like it's my way or the highway, but it's only one way. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's the way the guy before me did it, and it's not my way, but I think it's both. I think you do a great job describing it, not only honoring people, but what I heard you articulate is the way in which you, through all of these endeavors and in your own personal space, make space for that and to honor it. And I don't know. I mean, I think it's so natural to you that you probably think of it as like one step, but so many folks, and I think an interesting leadership kind of quality is you can honor talents from other people, you can recognize those talents, but you don't even get the ability to do that if you haven't made space to see them.
That's a good point.
And that's what you've described that you're doing, but there's a lot to what you're describing, and it's clear that you're considering those points.
I do that I was looking at proposals. I teach a research methods course this semester. And these are juniors, and they have to write a proposal for a research. So they have to do the real research and finding sources and so on. So they're at the point now just developing a question and so on. And some of the topics today I was looking at, and I would say, I don't know this topic at all. Teach me something.
Yeah.
And that's what I like to do. And I do this, and I bring that to the theater because I was, especially the leads, the ones who do the show, because they know my image, they know my image or what I want, my goal, but I'll say I didn't hire you, but I cast you because you are good actors, and I'll say you're at point A. By the end of the scene, I want you at point B. Find your way there.
Yeah.
And that's called trust. So trusting in those people and trusting in the students that teach me something. And I think that gives them a little bit of responsibility that, hey, he trusts me enough to say that I can teach him something or I know more. But you do. You know, I don't know everything about these subjects. You're coming up with subjects that some of these AI stuff.
Yeah.
Now, talk about being an old guy. I'm still Googling stuff. I don't AI stuff. And so...
So me too. I don't think that's an old thing. I just for what it's worth, I don't think that's an old thing. I'm like retraining myself to use AI the way I've historically used Google.
Yeah. So they're coming up with topics that... They're talking about this type of new technology. Well, then show me, teach me, and this is point A. You know how to get to point B, or what I expect from you for point B. Same thing with the acting, so it's similar to that.
Yeah, I think trust, which you described, and vulnerability, which you also modeled.
Right.
I don't know. Teach me.
Yes.
I still to this day don't know why people sometimes are afraid to say I don't know.
Exactly.
It can be a real missed opportunity by simply not raising your hand boldly and being like, what is that? What do you mean?
When I was a new teacher, and then when I was developing new teachers at USM, they have that, they're afraid to be vulnerable. So if they didn't know, they'll BS their way through through the answer. And it's like, nah, don't do that. They can easily just look it up in 2 seconds and find out you are making, you know, all of this stuff up. So, but in the old days when it took them, they had to go home and look in their encyclopedias. I quickly learned that, no, I don't know everything. I just know that I'm going to help you in your journey. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. That's how you have to develop the play. You have to develop your lesson plans and develop that. That, I think, is what the qualities of a good leader is, that you guide, you foster their freedom and then their growth.
Couldn't agree more. And it leads me to my next question. What are some of the lessons about leadership that you've learned from working with cast, crews, and musicians over the years? Like, what has been, beyond AI, what has been some of your learning?
it's getting to know your people. So sometimes it takes a few shows to know, okay, that person's pretty good at doing that or whatever. And also having a collaborative group of people around you. I like to, not because we don't pay, but hiring or getting a staff. The first thing is getting a good producer, because he or she has to do a lot of legwork. And I'm fortunate with Jennifer Groover. I'll call you. This is a shout out for you. She's been almost a year now. When I texted her, I said, "Do you have a few minutes to talk?" And that's probably she regrets saying yes, because it's getting sponsors, it's getting locations. The challenge with this show is that we are rehearsing at CLT in Auburn, but the show will be at Lewiston Middle School.
Yeah.
So we've got to move like a bus and truck tour in October. October 18 is moving day, and that means the sets are built, but they have to be portable so that we can put them together. The lighting, we can do all the lighting we want at CLT, but it's going to be different there. Even staging, I had them in certain spots. I said, well, when we get to the Lewiston Middle School stage, it's going to be wider. And then, but remember, we have a 26-piece orchestra, so you've got to give them room and so on. So that's those are the challenges. So it's getting people who are willing to share in your vision of the show, mm-hmm. and knowing who they are, and then trusting them. It's like I was talking to Brandon, Brandon Chalou, who's my stage manager. That's like just as important as a producer. Sorry, yeah. Jennifer, but they run the show, because you direct. They know your vision, and then by the time the show starts, I'm done. In professional theater, the director is not hanging around every night giving a pep talk before the show. He or she is out doing the next project or something. In professional theater, the stage manager will rehearse if there needs to be rehearsing. If there's an actor who will fill in or a change in acting, they take care of that. The director is done after opening night, and that's what we do as well. It's like I will still be there. It's not like I'm not going to. I want to see the show.
Yeah.
But that's who you trust. So you get a person that, here's the lighting. This is what I want. So we meet and we do that rehearsal. And then a sound person is important.
Yeah.
I have one of the best conductors and arrangers in Colin Britt. Colin Britt is a former local kid. It was when I wrote this show, he was a precocious 12-year-old hanging around me asking dozens of questions. He still apologizes. I said, no, you were a pain, but it was a good pain. And now he's the doctor, Colin Britt, and he's well-known in the community of music. He was on America's Got Talent, as a matter of fact, with a little chorale and an orchestra. They did Call Me Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know if you ever saw that. That was that group. If you Google it, you'll see that was Colin Britt's idea.
Huh.
So he arranged it for an orchestra and like a chorale. Sorry, Colin, if it isn't perfectly what you had planned. But he's my arranger. So I'll have the music, and I make a recording and of what I want on my keyboard, and then I'll send it to him, and then we'll write back, what do you want here, like an oboe here, so on and on. So he arranges it for a 26-piece orchestra. So that's done. I don't have to worry about that because I can trust him.
I keep getting stuck on and astounded by a 26-piece orchestra. That's pretty big for local theater.
That's why it's at Lewiston Middle School.
That makes sense. Yeah. I was wondering if that was the driving factor.
That's why, because that would take up our stage at CLT.
Yeah.
And so they're still a big part of the stage at Lewiston Middle School, but we're in front, and we minimize all the movement. It's like a troop of actors coming in to tell a story. Meanwhile, we got 26 people behind us who are going to be playing music.
And are, by all intents and purposes, also helping tell the story. Right?
Yes,
like it
absolutely.
Wouldn't be,
right, absolutely.
And you wrote the music.
Yes.
The first time and the second.
Yes, I've written all the music and lyrics.
For a guy who was just picking up music best you could on your own.
Yeah.
and went to school for math.
Yeah. Well, I knew.
Way that, to work it out, sir. Well,
I knew that I could have insurance and a retirement if I taught math.
Yeah.
The theater part, I didn't know. So, but it helps fuel my passion. So.
Which feeds you in every other aspect of your life.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense to me. I am curious about the crossover of you in academia, you as a professor, not just a professor, but a professor of leadership studies, mm-hmm. specifically. How do the lessons you learn and teach transfer from space to space? I can't imagine it's completely separate, right? So there's leadership lessons that you're teaching in an academic environment that I'm sure you're bringing or modeling to your community spaces. And likewise, there must be things that are happening in those community spaces that are informing your next leadership lesson plan.
I'll have to be very forthcoming. I am not a leadership and organizational studies scholar. My PhD is in math and science, and I was originally hired at USM to be math and science in the education department. We had it, and at Lewiston Auburn College, which was its own college back in 1999, we had an education program. So I would be teaching math and science methods to our K-8 teachers, and also doing observation of their practicum, going to schools and watching them. And I did that until 3 years ago now. So then 3 years ago, they combined the program, and of course, Lewiston Auburn College really doesn't exist anymore. Lewiston Auburn College campus exists now.
Right.
So I still have my office at the Lewiston Auburn campus, but then I because I was teaching stats, the leadership and organizational studies needed a stats professor.
I shiver. I was an economics degree holder, and stats was the bane of my existence academically. I'm going to remember this.
Boy, stats and green peppers. It's like
You thought I was likable until you got to know me.
So they stats is one of their core courses. It's a USM core course.
Yeah.
In fact, it's packed to the gills, but it was in my classes, my two courses that I teach, two sections. So I became the stats for LOS, and then when I could see the education piece going away, I was also in the math. I was also in the natural applied sciences teaching physics at the same time, and that was going away because Lewiston Auburn College was losing its college-ness for that. So I went over and talked to the provost, said, "Hey, can I go to LOS before I lose my job?" And she said, sure. And so I got in there. Then those programs disappeared, but I was safely in LOS. So I teach stats most of the time. Huh. I teach stats to underclassmen and to PhD students, and because we have a PhD program. So the leadership courses, I don't really teach leadership courses. Mm-hmm. I teach research methods courses. So
you know, you could. I'm just saying after today, I think you could maybe.
Probably. I would have to get a little bit more scholarship. So when I'm on a committee for a dissertation, I'll tell the student, the PhD candidate, right up front, I will focus on the methodology, your stats methodology, but the research that you've done and the scholarship that you've done, I can't give you a good, it's almost like teach me something.
Yeah.
Because I don't have that scholarship behind me, but I do have it for the stats and the methodology. So that's how I can be a leader in that respect.
Yeah.
So I'm very rarely, only once have I been a committee chair, because in the LOS department, they'll pick an LOS expert. But there was a student, we just got his degree, his PhD a couple of months ago, and he asked me to be on his chair because he was a physics teacher in high school, which I was. He was also a coach, which I was. And he saw a lot of parallels, and I knew what he was doing and why he was doing it. So I was very honored to be in his chair, and he had actually a co-chair because he needed an LOS person. And he'll say that I was like a good cop, you know, like so. And it's just like saying you're doing a good job. You're going to get it. Don't worry, because getting a PhD and writing a dissertation can be a harrowing experience. Because and he had two kids, and his wife was expecting a third one right when he's ready to defend. So life was in the way. But it's like it's like, you can do this. And I'm not one to be very motherly-handed. It's even at the theater. It's like, what's the problem? Okay, well, good. What do you need from me? Good. Then do it. I need it by October 15th, that type of thing.
I think I follow that particular model a little. There's a little bit of mothering that I do, but that makes a ton of sense to me. Let's talk about the Thrive component. So when we talk in our final segment about thriving, we're talking about sustaining energy and defining success and looking forward to the future. What do you hope a new home gives to the community now, almost 30 years after its original debut?
That is a good question, and I think I have a half-decent answer. Mm-hmm. Talk about the first act, second scene. That's the Irish and the French come mm-hmm. up, and they... That's when Donovan meets Madeline, and there's like little sparks going.
Little West Side Story moment.
The West Side Story one. So that's in 1916. Towards the end of the play, when we bring in the new Mainers into play, we have... two park benches at Kennedy Park. We have the local kids, and we have new Mainers coming in. And the dialogue that the new Mainers say is almost the same as what was said by the Irish in 1916. And same thing with the, why do they hate us so much is the question. And it don't really hate us. It's more of ignorance or resentment. Mm. They think you're taking over the city, or you're taking their jobs, or you're living free and the thing. Looking up, you can research this, the Irish, or even before the Irish. When the Irish first came here, there was that talk, the Yankees were the ones that were saying mm-hmm. that about the Irish. You can read about that in Boston, how the Irish were not accepted at all. It'd be signs, no Irish to yeah. be hired, so on. So they've gone, every new community who comes in has almost the same thing. So I hope that people can see that these new communities that come in always have this barrier to fight, mm-hmm. and so maybe we can lower the barrier a little bit mm-hmm. and ease the pain of a new way of life. One of the things that the new Mainers came here is that they're escaping war. They're not illegals, and that's one of the lines in the show, because one of the kids says, all these illegals coming in. And then they even talked about it. Said, "Where did these? How come these kids are saying?" And one of the kids, I have young kids, and so they're high school kids, and said they probably heard it from their parents. And I said, "Yeah, you're right. You don't. You got to be carefully taught to talk that way." So it parallels. And the rehearsal Monday night, I took the kids, and I said, "I want you to watch the Irish and French here, mm-hmm. and I want you to watch their actions." It's 1916, and they're playing catch with a ball, baseball. They're talking about the Red Sox. The Red Sox were good. They were just won the World Series, blah, blah, blah. Now, in 2016, we're talking about the Patriots. They're playing with a soccer ball, and the Patriots had just beaten Atlanta, the greatest comeback ever in the Super Bowl. So that's the conversation. So it starts with a sports thing, and it ends up with the new Mainers coming in and said, uh-oh, here they come. Which is what the Irish said when the French came. So there's parallels. I want people to realize that this has been going on for centuries. And so someday these new Mainers will be sitting on that side of the, on that park bench, and there will be new immigrants coming in. Mm. So they need to realize, too, it'll be maybe 100 years from now, like with these people, when you would read when the new Mainers came in 2000, they were saying things that, like, folks, did you forget what your grandparents told you?
Yeah.
How it was when they came here? They mm-hmm. were ashamed to be French, or there were signs, no French to be hired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you forget that? And I didn't forget that. So it just, that's what we hope. Maybe it's not a reality, but that's the hope, that you can see that we are all, we've all immigrants. We've all been through the same dialogue, the same conversation has been happening. Yeah. Maybe it can be tempered a bit when the next group of new Mainers mm-hmm. or new Lewistoners come in.
Yeah. No, I think that I share that hope. I've shared that hope in other places. Thanks for bringing such a creative and enjoyable way to help move that hope closer towards reality, because that's been my experience. I come from a community that just really candidly, like, had no immigrants, had no significant history of immigrants except for the way in which we think of colonialism. And right. and like everybody arrived, and there was certainly indigenous people before. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, it was like eight generations back for everybody's family tree. And, you know, we're from Massachusetts when Massachusetts was what we called Maine, right?
Right.
And so when I moved here, I started doing, interestingly enough, some research into our housing stock. So I was focused in public health, and I was looking at lead poisoning rates, and the history of our housing stock was the history of immigration all the way through. And so some of the story that you're describing is a story that I learned through this like really very different lens. Like there's a workforce lens around the history of immigration and how it's shaped our economy. But I was looking through it through specifically housing. And as somebody who had no experience with immigration or immigrants, came from a really homogenous small rural community, and was trying to do some sense making about like how does the demographics and the immigration story of those, or the migration story of those immigrants, how does that shape this community and specifically its housing? And I just, as I learned it from different people, firsthand accounts from different, from Irish immigrants, from Franco immigrants, from African immigrants, what stood out to me is how similar the story was and how short the memory was. And I just, I couldn't make sense of that because I had no, there was no reference point for me in my life and my experience and my upbringing to make sense of it. And so I just approached those conversations with real curiosity that was like, well, isn't that thing that you're saying the same thing that your parents and grandparents said was said about them? Mm-hmm. Like I just a really naive or innocent perspective. And well, yes, but it's different. And I'm like, how can you teach me how it's different? Because I don't understand.
Right.
And so I love that you've not only done a play once but twice about that theme and that you are seeing that same parallel. So not new home specific, but when you look at the role of arts and music in Lewiston Auburn's future, what excites you the most?
Well, that's a great question. What excites me the most? I think it's the continuing development of people who are interested in music.
Mm.
A friend, Brian Gagnon, who would run the School of Rock, now he's moved to Florida. And he was in the original orchestra for this play, as a matter of fact. He was just a kid. He's still a kid. But it's just getting kids interested in music and music programs. So there's an excitement about that, but it's also a fear that some of those programs are the ones that are first gone. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big believer that if you want your kids to be good at math or in school, mm-hmm. teach them music. Music and math go together.
Says a math teacher.
Yeah, exactly.
You need to put that on a shirt and wear it.
It's all about patterns. So music is patterns. Math is patterns.
Mm-hmm.
That's another a podcast for how we teach math and so on. But that's the thing I see when I see kids in bands at an age, because if you look at music in today's world, where are the bands, for instance? There are no bands in the top 40.
And
not that I'm a big top 40 person now, but I don't know the bands. But I would like to see more different types of community theaters. There are some very strong community theaters, such as you said, in Monmouth.
Mm-hmm.
There's Oxford. And then if you go to Portland, you have not only the Portland Lyric and Portland Players, but you have the Good Theater. You have other theaters. And then over here, we have the Public Theater. And Public Theater has done a few musicals. And then in Maine State is now connected with Auburn at the new I think it's Donald Gay Theater.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, right now they're doing a show a week for 3 weeks. So they're,
I'm a season ticket holder for that series, trying to support it. Well, and they just did the Irish and How They Got That Way, which
was
also a really interesting immigration show that I got to catch.
I saw that as well. So there's things happening in here. I think it's just that one of the challenges is to get the new people who have come to here to appreciate that, but I think they have so much other things to think about before they can take time to enjoy. But they have their family, like the New Mainers I know from their singing community, like in church, that they sing in their families.
Yeah.
And that's like my family, and it just has to grow out, and then they can share those stories. I had for a short time in my choir, my Holy Family Choir, I had a person, a New Mainer, a young girl, and she was there for a short time. She was traveling from Portland to Lewiston, so I knew that was going to be a challenge, but at the time I said, can you bring me a traditional African Catholic song or something we can do, or at least you can do? It's tough to, and I didn't want to incorporate my French white choir to be doing an African song, but I wanted her to be able to do it. I just want to show us again, teach me something. So I think there's a community there that can teach us something through music and art. So that's my hope, and that would be really exciting to see more of that. I know there are some little events that happen when they do their dancing and music in town on Lisbon Street or near different areas.
Yeah.
I think there needs to be more of that and more publicity about it and more at even a bigger level.
I love that. part of what I really love and just want to like lift up about your framing is what I often try to characterize as like not yet isn't no, it's just not yet.
Right. And we have to have available doors, for lack of a better word, for them to see that
it's creating space again.
Yes, creating space for them. So, and you're right, the basic needs have to be taken care of. I've got to feed my family. Yeah. I don't have time to go spend 3.5 hours at community theater and dance around for some 6:30 to 9 to 10 o'clock. So I don't have that time. And I know that because my grandparents didn't do that.
Yeah.
When they came here, they had to, find a place to live and find a job and work 10 hours a day. It does take, a generation or two. It'll be interesting to see from those, because it's only been a generation and a quarter here for 25 years since the first major group of people came.
Yeah.
So hopefully I can see it in my lifetime.
Yeah, yeah, same. Thank you. As we close, we like to just reflect for a minute. And I guess the conversation that we'd want to end with and that we want to leave our listeners also thinking about, what's the one message that you hope people carry with them after hearing what you've shared with us today?
I think that there's a lot of good in every community, including Lewiston. And that's what we're trying to show, is that Lewiston, we can talk about Lisbon Street's not the same. It never was the same. It's one of the lines in the show about we're always romanticizing certain parts of the city. Enjoy what you have now. When I was here, I used to walk from the gas patch to go to work. I'd walk right over here, down and past Grandma's house, all the way down to 10 Lisbon Street, listening to my portable radio. In 1970,
like boombox on your shoulder.
Yeah, it was
style?
A little portable radio, a little Panasonic.
That
was before. I was the geek walking around Lisbon Street though, with that thing near my
kind
head.
Of people.
Yeah, because the ear plug didn't work that well. It was just one ear plug. They weren't earbuds in those days. But and I walked down Lisbon Street, and you had the vagrants, and you had this problem, and you had that problem, and it's like, oh, Lisbon Street was so good. Really, it wasn't that great when I was walking there. But it was a greater before, so we tend to romanticize. So I think we have to appreciate what we have here. Yes, we have tragedy. We've had grief, but we've had some very big moments. And I think it's just a matter of taking pride in whatever community you have. And that's why it's called a new home. It's not called Lewiston a new home. So you can take pride in, if you come see the show, you can take pride in your own community because of what was built by the people who came before you. And also with hope at the end of this play that now you have a new group of people who will carry the story. The narrator of the show says at the end of the play that it is now up to you, talking to the audience, to continue this story because we just told our story. So if they do this play or a version of it in 30 years, Who knows who's going to add to it and what songs you can add to it. It'll be a five-hour show, but or you can take part of it out. But that's what I hope to see happen in this show, that there's some pride in living in this community.
I love that. There's not a day goes by that is not a goal I'm trying to achieve in some element of the work that I do here. I think this is an incredible community with incredible assets, including its people and its nature and recreation and arts and food and agriculture. And I just wish people would spend more time using an asset-based lens and really enjoying that which they're contributing to and surviving off of. Mark,
yes.
Anything you want
to... Yeah, I mean, I'd like to applaud the entire interview. Paul, what a gem of a human you are.
Right?
And it was great hearing your story, and so thankful that you're part of our community. I have a daughter who didn't know quite where she fit in high school, and we encouraged her to go into theater, and she did, and became an entirely different person. Mm. Confidence and creativity, and it was amazing. And the first time I saw her on stage, I cried.
Yeah.
I was, sure. Like, I'd never seen her in that capacity. And earlier, when you were talking about your high school days, you said that you didn't feel seen or appreciated until your senior year.
Yeah.
Right. How did that present itself?
Well,
Thank you.
I went to public school. I went to St. Mary's School. I was a little parochial school right near the Heritage Center, and very parochial. And then they closed the school for boys. So I had to go to Fry School, which was every school I've been to is now a public is now housing, apparently.
Yeah.
So I went there, and then I went to St. Don's when it was on Blake Street, and I was the new kid from a public school. I'd gone to Jordan Junior High, again, another apartment complex. I was the kid who felt ashamed to be from the gas patch. Mm-hmm. But I was fortunate to have friends who took me in, I could say. And I still, we had a class reunion last year, 50th reunion. And I saw some of them, and I was crying, telling them, thank you for taking me as this geeky kid here. Yeah. And I didn't play, I love playing sports. I wanted to play baseball. Couldn't play because can't see. So those were the things that were challenges, and I wanted to be part of something as a usual 14, 15, 16-year-old kid. 17th, my senior year, there was a music group, and they knew I played piano, and they needed a piano player, so they asked me to play the piano, and that's like, boom. It was your daughter.
Yeah.
It was my spot.
Yeah.
And mom and dad took delight in me. It's like, oh, he's been playing at the house all this time, but never. It's like, and from then on, it just went on from there. So that's what happened my senior year. I'll have to do a shout out to the teacher, Roland Roy. He's the one who came up to me and said, I hear you play piano. I want you in the group. It wasn't like asking. I want you in the group to play to accompany.
You will do this.
Yes, exactly.
And you will enjoy it.
Yes, and you will do well. I did okay. And so I shout out to him, because when I hear students say that, oh, my favorite teacher was blah da da da, I say, have you told them? Are they still around to tell them? You should tell them. Yeah. Teachers need to hear that. Mm-hmm. So that's shout out, Mr. Roy.
Yeah, I just echo. I echo what Mark said. Like, I knew we'd talk about the show today, and had a sense till I did some of my research with a very short bio. The way you refer to your wife gave me an insight that this could be a really interesting interview. But you are a wonderful human, doing really great things, and doing so pretty humbly, if I might add. Mm-hmm. And I just appreciate you not just taking the time to talk with us today and to share your story with our listeners, but thanks for making that story that you shared with us here, and doing that with our neighbors and our community, and then also sharing it.
Well, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
We're gonna get to know you. We're gonna talk it out. We're gonna get to know you and what you're all about. We're gonna get to know just what makes you feel alive. We're gonna get to know how you build, lead, and thrive.
Build, Lead, and Thrive. Voices of the Androscoggin.